UGA, BAM, Hadassah, and so on. And they said, you know, these people to whom you want to talk, they are not on our list. We can't get them for you. And I always had trouble meeting people in whom I was very much interested. And even now, in Israel, usually just the same thing happens. You meet people for whom I have the highest regard, but they have already emotional ties to Israel. And I think the big difference between anything we did so far in the relationship between Israel and Jews abroad and what is supposed to be, in my opinion, the future link, the big difference is that so far we could count on an existing emotional relationship based on actually and essentially the same background. I would say that people 30 years ago in Israel of all ages and those living at the same time abroad, they were essentially the same. And I could very well imagine somebody in Jerusalem on a Pesach night reciting the sentence, the next year Yerushalayim, Shana Habaa Yerushalayim, and yet he would actually think about his father's home back in the diaspora where this sentence has been said, just the same as it would come into the mind of a Jew being in Poland, in Germany, or in the United States. Without even knowing the same language, if it was here Hebrew and there English, they had the same feeling, the same ideas, the same tradition. Today, I would say we could be, if we, and sometimes we are, worlds apart. Because you have roots in the United States. And the people here, over 50% are youngsters born in this country. And of the other 50%, 50% again did not come from countries which you would understand easily their mentality. And I think, therefore, to establish a closer relationship between the younger generations within the Jewry is a must. You know that right now at this young university, for the first time this year, we started a foreign students program. We hesitated doing it because we felt before that we were not yet right for it. But today, because of this reason, we decided that it is a must for every Jewish institution in this country, every Jewish educational institution, to bring over Jewish youngsters from abroad. Even if it means, and it means sometimes, there's no need to hide it. Even if it means sometimes that we cannot accept all the Israeli applicants for a place in the university. Even then, sometimes, I have learned it the hard way in the army, you have to allocate priorities. This is a priority. This is a priority. More than that, I don't believe that by just reading newspapers or once a year going to a UJA meeting, we really can build a united Jewry. United meaning that one understands the other. Not more than that. But I believe that if someone spends a year here studying, or a year here working, he will come back home. Well, first of all, he may stay. That's certainly good. But even if he doesn't, he comes back home with a completely different understanding. He will know for his whole life what Israel means, what the Israeli youngsters look like, what life in Israel is in reality. And more than that, he will be linked to Judaism and to Israel forever. He will come home with at least some knowledge in Hebrew, and he will keep it for his whole life, for him and probably his children. That makes the whole difference. Too often, we believe, I said, I welcome you, I hope you will be here again next year, be it for 4 weeks, and yet I believe that we should not do just with 4 weeks. Because then, mostly, you see the rosy sides of life. Very difficult to go and see the small details which make life sometimes difficult for people. It is just natural that one would like to show you the brighter side of life, the achievements. But there have also been setbacks, and you should know them, and the reasons for them. And it is therefore that I say, if you can, come not only for 4 weeks, come for a longer time, and learn to know Israel the way it is really. And establish personal contacts, personal ties with people and families in this country. Because in the final end, it is no sense in talking about a relationship between Israel and the United States, Israeli Jewry and the American Jewry, if you have no personal ties to it, if it depends only on you like the idea, you may give some money, you may talk, you may go to a meeting, it's not enough. If you are one people, there must be ties to it, personal ties. People whom you know and whom you can point out and say, this is somebody I know there. It is not just something else about which one can talk without any real feeling and real relation. But it is because not of the of this aspect of it that I came to the university. And I think you should know about it just as well. This is a young university. One reason that I picked out to come here and work here and not go anywhere else. You have been told, I guess, the university is about 10 years, 4 years, or 4.5 years on this location, has about 8,000 students today, more to come, more problems to come, more difficulties to come, I guess. And yet, I think that there should be more universities in the country if we want to become, to maintain or to become, let's say, a modern people and a modern country. You cannot do without it. Times have changed even in this country. And if 30 years ago the farmer, the settler, and the soldier, sometimes later, they were the accepted heroes of Israel, today, it's the farmer still, the soldier still, but there are more to it now today. The scientist, he is just as well an accepted hero, and we need him in this country if we don't want to become a backward country. If we want modern industry, we must have people who know how to run it, how to build it, how to develop it. If we want to stay independent, we must have people capable to keep us independent. And one would be completely wrong to assume that this is guaranteed because Jews have been regarded by everybody in the world as being a people or the people of the book, which means on one side the Bible, on the other side a people who knows to read and to write and to study. It is by no means guaranteed. We have at this moment only about, I'm not talking about universities, take high schools. We have about, what, 30% of our population of the younger generation graduating from high school? 30% in the United States you have graduating from colleges. And if you take the Jewish younger generation, 70% of them are graduating from college. If we are not making a specific effort, we will not be the people of the book, not be the people of reading, not people to be the people who is able to do research, development, writing, and certainly Israel will not be the cultural center for Jewry, something which is, it must be, if we are not or haven't been wrong for all the years. This has been the main idea behind everything, to establish again a country and a state which could serve as a cultural center for Jews all over. And in addition to it, to make it possible for everyone who wants to come or has the necessity to come and live here a fruitful life. While one may be for the time being guaranteed by people who just do the work, the other one, the cultural center, is not guaranteed unless we make an effort to give everybody of our younger generation the possibility to pick up education. If we succeed in doing this, by building a greater network of universities, then we will also have more space for youngsters from abroad to come, to study here, to mix with Israeli youngsters. And I believe that there can be no greater importance given to this point. And I would say that if the mission of my generation has been to create the homeland, to make it possible for more people to come, the mission of the younger generation will be to use the created opportunity for establishing a meeting ground for Jewish youngsters all over the world, and to establish and to renew the personal, emotional ties between Jews in Israel and Jews abroad. I wish you a very nice and fruitful stay in Israel and a good journey home.
Thank you, General Doran. I told you before that we've been out now for about 5 weeks or more. We've been to many meetings, we've heard many speeches, we've worked hard, we're tired. But this afternoon, this group was not tired. I think they all felt like I do. I was deeply moved, sure they were, by your very stirring appeal to strengthen the bonds between American Jewish youth and Israeli youth. Bramowitz of Miami Beach, but we're not listening to him as a rabbi today. We're listening to him as a friend. I knew him there, and on my last visit a couple of years ago, on the eve of the Israel Emergency Fund of 1967, which was shortly before the war broke out, when I came down with Minister of Finance Pinchas Sapir, Rabbi Abramowitz was a pillar of strength, and in this case, he wasn't a rabbi who was afraid to squeeze his congregants. He brought them up, and he worked hard at the suite, and he helped us immensely in the fulfillment of Mr. Sapir's mission. He is now taking a leave of absence for a while. You haven't left Miami for good, or maybe you should.
Hopefully.
He is here as the assistant to the president, special assistant to the president for American matters. Rabbi Abramowitz.
General Barone and my dear friend Sam, friends, I'm going to speak at 4 minutes if you clock me when I tell you start. At that time, I'll finish at 4 minutes, all right? I want you to know that I've been a rabbi for 17 years in Miami, and I'm willing to forget the 17 years for the 17-day experience I've been having thus far at Tel Aviv University. In one word, as we say in Israel today, it's fantastic. And if you don't know Hebrew, I can tell you that the Hebrew for fantastic is fantastic, all right? It is a kind of experience that I would not in any way trade, whether it is to get the accolades of the American Jewish community or even the UJA. And I say to you, I saw Sam, he and I pulled a fast squeeze play. He said, squeeze. I had a little Jew coming to the Fontainebleau Hotel to meet Sapir, and I only brought him to meet Sapir, by the way. This is a true story. So I knew that the man had just bought a bond for $10,000, and our job was to get that bond over like fast. And before the poor man knew what was happening between Sam and me, this man parted with $10,000, and it was within 30 seconds. I want you to know, Sam, he has yet to speak to me again. But all these wonderful experiences that I had, I would gladly trade for the experience that I've been having here. It began last December when Dr. Wise, the genius of this university, who came up with one ingenious idea. Now, you heard General Doron tell you how important the university is for Tel Aviv. Tel Aviv now gives the name to the university. Within 5 years, I guarantee you, Tel Aviv City will be known by the magnificence of Tel Aviv University. They'll say, oh, that's the city where the university is in. Because this is what is happening to Tel Aviv University. It is the highest, from a point of view of caliber of studies, from the point of view of the kind of progress in education that is being made daily. And of course, the point of view within 5 years, you'll have 40,000 students here. That's right, 40,000 students. Now, when Dr. Wise came to Miami Beach, we had bets amongst ourselves. One professor said, if you get 50 students, I think you're the one that lost the bet, right, Jim? If you have 50 students, it'll be a lot. And someone said, 100 students is maximum. And Dr. Wise said, we need 200. And by the way, we got 200. To be exact, what is it, Alan? About 180 some odd? Where are we going right now? I want to tell you only, and now you start timing me, all right? Now I want to tell you the uniqueness of this program, of bringing freshmen and other types of students to come and to spend 1 year for study. When we spoke to them, we were shocked. Do you know the majority of students of Alan Starfield's type who are here spending a year? Alan is a freshman student here. Alan, stand up. Let them see you. Stand up, Alan. Now, Alan has decided to come. I don't know Alan, but I do know the other 22 that came here. Thank you, Alan. I want you to know something. I want you to know something. Most, and I mean most in terms of like 90% of 180, are non-Zionists, non-committed, didn't know a damn thing. I'm going to yell, but that's how I feel about Israel. Now, what made them come? I can tell you what made them come. When we announced at a high school guidance office that we want to make a presentation at Tel Aviv University, ordinary American kids came down to hear the story. And they came because of the adventure of living in a foreign land, and they came because deep in the recesses of their hearts, whether you like it or not, whether you admit it or not, there is the, in Yiddish we call it the funk, the spark, the something, called Jewish, called Israel, called tradition, I don't know, called fiddle on the roof, whatever you want to call it. And coming to Israel for that 1 year kindles that spark. Now, here, this university has created a lot of problems, this program. How many applications do you think we get by them? Take a guess. Each year, there are 8,000 students. How many thus far do we have applications of Israeli freshmen? Somebody take a guess, please.
1,500.
You say 1,500? Any others?
40,000.
Freshmen.
5,000 freshmen have already applied. How many do you think will be rejected? 3,000 will be rejected. You know why? Because there just aren't facilities there. And I'm making a pitch. Unless you want me to say, you want a pitch? No? There aren't the facilities or the professors. And the resentment the American student has begun by saying, well, 100 Israelis won't be able to be stuck to study. Some of the Israeli people said a very interesting thing. You Americans want to come here? Go build the university yourself here and bring the Israeli students. And the American students, I close by saying to you as follows. In a sense, the money given to the UJA directly to Tel Aviv builds this university. And so I know Gerald Durand will be the first one to admit that it is a cooperative venture of American Jews with their funds that has built this university. And now we're spreading forth and saying, it is the cooperative venture of Israeli students and American students that will further the real mission that is Tel Aviv University. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much. You're a man of your word. From the point we started clocking you, it was exactly 4 minutes.
Oh, you timed it, huh?
Now, it was all right. I time every speaker, but this is a habit. It's nothing. It's nothing personal. But thank you very much. You can see now why Rabbi Abramowitz's congregation in Miami Beach is the liveliest place for sermons. I've been there. We appreciate very much what he's told us, and we wish him the greatest success in developing his program of bringing American students here for at least a year, for that trial year. The speaker, it is only right that we'll hear from the representative of the student body of this university to tell us something about student life, maybe even problems. He is with us at lunch today, and I want to call on Eli Shaket. Eli Shaket. Is that right? Eli's bad American.
So first of all, as a student in Tel Aviv University, I will give you a good advice, simply to come here to learn in Tel Aviv University. I belong to the young generation of the Israeli society, and last war, I fight with the paratroops to deliver the old city and the wailing wall. I and my friends decided that we may memorize our friends that did not return from the battlefield only by keeping the victory. And we can keep the victory only by concentration with Jewish people in Israel. We decided to establish groups of absorption and make a direct connection, as General Doron said, personal ties with groups of the young Jewry in the United States. We, the young people of the Israeli society, believe, and we are sure, that between East and West, my home is best, and my home is in Israel, and I want you to know that Israel may be not only a country for you, but also a home.
I want to thank you, Eli. Eli.
Yes.
For your inspiring words. They're short, I think very moving. I think they epitomize what this is all about.
Do you have any questions?
General Doron, I think with this kind of student body, the future of Israel is quite secure. And we, American Jewish students, will want certainly, I'm certain in the years to come, more and more to cooperate with these students and with the younger this younger generation of Israel. I think we're all going back greatly inspired by what we've heard this afternoon from you and from the others, and we want to thank you for it. Now, with your permission, may we ask some questions for a few minutes? Are there any questions? Buddy, this is Buddy Levine of Leominster.
This is the rabbi. How does a student in the United States go about applying to the university, either here in Tel Aviv or Technion or Hebrew University? How do they go about applying?
Applications are made directly to the American Friends of Tel Aviv University at something like 41 East 41st Street. Just a second. The application is as follows. If you are and you are not a high school graduate, you forward your transcript of the high school records to this particular office with the SATs, and admissions committee then, and with all the other necessary documents, the admissions committee then informs you within 30 days accepted or not. Number two. If you are a sophomore student this year or this coming year and you want to come under a special junior program, then the same application is made. You forward your college records to this university. Hold it. I know what you got in mind. I'll get to it. And the admissions committee decides upon your qualification, yes or no. If you are not a junior student, you want a one-year student, anyone, a sophomore or a senior. We have now one of the seniors who is going to graduate from Antioch College based on the senior work that he's doing now here at Tel Aviv University. This is a fantastic first, I think, for any educational institution. Never happened before. Now, I want to tell you how Tel Aviv University judges your application. And this is Professor Yavis told me, when I met General Dorn, I realized what the uniqueness of this institution. At first, we all were worried about SATs, you know, us scores. And we were worried about what percentile are you in your graduating your class. And we were worried about the kind of C's or B's, or God forbid, D's that you make. This university doesn't give a damn about your marks. As a matter of fact, we have a problem now, we're discussing with General Dorn. There are kids who want to come back next year to their own universities. And we need, of course, we need marks to indicate the kind of progress they're making. Now listen. The most important thing for admission to Tel Aviv University is that somebody who knows you in the educational field, a professor, a guidance instructor, a head of the department, even a rabbi, three recommendations will say, George Schmulowitz, who is a student in such and such a school, has a potential for adjustment, for growth, for scholarship, for learning. Those kind of personal recommendations weigh quite heavily in the applications and admissibility of a student. So they really judge you on your, don't misunderstand me, the university stands extremely high scholastically, but they judge you on your personal commitment and readiness to adjust. Now, technically speaking, you take 1 year at the university here. If you want to return to the university of your choice, the record is sent from this university to your University of America. We have yet to experience, and I tell you, haven't had it yet, but I can tell it to you straight, in any university I've applied to, or Tel Aviv University, where the dean would say, we cannot accept. Universally, the top universities have already said to Tel Aviv University, we accept the accreditation. That's a kind of long answer to a short question.
Are there any more questions?
I neglected to point out something very important. My God, I neglected to point out something. You are.
Go ahead, ask the question.
It's a quick question. I wanted to know, the school depends upon funds from the United States, does it not?
I'll answer part of it and I'll have General Don't follow me, all right?
All right, next part of that question is, does the government of Israel help in any way?
General Don will answer that question too. Okay. If you give me a figure, we'll get two answers, all right?
Okay.
Now, you kids, ladies and gentlemen, know what a college education costs in America. I bet you if I asked you here, we'd get an average cost per student here between $3,000 and $4,000 a year, right or wrong, what it costs to your parents.
Yeah.
How much?
I'm talking about room and board and dormitories and fees and... of course it is. Now, I say average. Tel Aviv University has made this offer to American students. For $1,800, $1,800, you receive all your dormitory facilities, one meal a day in Israel. This is the big meal, the lunch meal. You receive dormitory, tuition, and board, that one meal a day, for $1,800 plus getting you there and flying you there. $1,800. I think from that point of view, it's a fantastic bargain. You know how much of this money you're giving to your university and how much you're getting to the government of Israel.
What do you lose?
How much
do you lose? No university.
We would lose. You have right.
Of course.
We would lose unless both the Israeli government and the Jewish agency would subsidize the program to some extent. But even so, I think that if you deduct the fare in New York, Tel Aviv, New York, and you leave then about, what, $1,200 for a year, or 11 months, 11 and a half months, and it does include whatever Rabbi Abramovich said, and in addition to it, a lot of cultural activities and trips within the in the country, I think that it is a relatively low pay if you compare it with any place, anywhere. In addition to it, if somebody of those present here or some of your friends will inquire about it, I would say that lack of funds, just as it is in this country and in this university for Israelis, lack of funds will not be a reason not to be accepted at Tel Aviv University. Not for an Israeli and not for any student abroad. If there is a student capable and willing to do his study here, we will find the funds if he hasn't.
I think there was another part to the question about how the general funds for operating the university are raised. Is that right?
Yes.
And what part do you get from the United States, capital and
operating?
And from the government of Israel.
And government of Israel and other sources.
I omitted to talk about the university, being sure that you have been told so much about so many institutions, and everyone has told you that their funds are just not there, not available. I would like to make first one point about the university. Tel Aviv University not only has it been growing so far, but it is bound or doomed or whatever you call it to grow. The reason is that it is located in the center of the population. And more than that, as far as the students' body is concerned, I don't think that we are really competing with Jerusalem. We may want to compete in standards, but we are not competing about the same student. And the reason is that despite the fact that Jerusalem, the distance between Tel Aviv and Jerusalem is only about, what, 60 miles or 50 miles, it is not commuting distance. It is not commuting distance. If you live in Tel Aviv and you want to study in Jerusalem, either you live there, or if you don't live there, at least you have to forget about one thing. You cannot be working at the same time. At Tel Aviv University, 50% of our students are at least part-time workers who would never be able to do their studies in Jerusalem. For them it is either Tel Aviv or not to study. And this is the rationale behind having a university at this place. And there were a lot of discussions before, in addition to the points I made before about education in general and the necessity of the education in the country, but there were a lot of discussions about having or not having the university, what size of university, what kind of university. It is a fact that without Tel Aviv University, 50% of the 8,000 would not be able to attend university at all. Now about the money. Our operating budget in the year 68-69 is 40 million Israeli pounds, which is about 12 million dollars. Out of this 40 million, approximately 68% come from public sources. The major part, the Israeli government, and a small part, about 8%, from the Tel Aviv municipality. So they pay really a relatively low price for having Tel Aviv University called Tel Aviv University. But altogether it's 68%. 10 additional percent is the income from tuition fee. An Israeli student, or any student, pays 740 pounds tuition fee. Actually, it's only 740 for all kinds of student organizations, sports, all kinds of taxes. This is a very low tuition you pay. As a matter of fact, tuition in the university is about half the amount you pay in high school. But as I said before, there are scholarships available, and we will do everything in our power that should there be a student or a potential student, a candidate, an applicant, who has no means or only part of the means, we will do everything in our power to get him into the university and to give him the money, not only for his studies, but even some of the money to live on. So this leaves us with about 20% deficit. And if you ask me what I'm doing all day long and all year long, I'm looking for the 20%. And it's very hard to find. Very hard to find. Usually, we close up the year and we still have the deficit. In addition to it, the development budget of the university this year amounts to, let's say, 25 million Israeli pounds, out of which at least half of the money is cash outlay. I mean, you can build and have credit given to you by the construction company to a certain extent. But 50% of your program you'll have to pay for. If you pay for what you do now, if you pay for what you did last year, it means about 12.5 million pounds to pay for a 25 million program this year. We have a phase one development program of just over 100 million Israeli pounds, and so far we have put up 65, or paid out 65 million pounds, and 35 more to go. Usually I'm asked of such an opportunity, and you are not worried, you are talking about deficit, you are talking about 12.5 million money outlay, but you will have to have the other part as well, the other 50%. I'm worried about it, and I don't sleep very well because of that. And actually, I think in such a situation, one should be responsible for it, one should run away. The only compensation I have, and I would invite you to join me, is at 5 o'clock, this is the busiest hour at the university, to go in the new buildings which have been created, almost all of them during my time here, not because of me, but during my time here, go at this time into these buildings and see thousands of students come, study, happy about their studies, and then you forget about money, and I think that's the best thing to do, and you really, I think it's a gratifying feeling for everyone.
Any more questions? General Doran, I want to thank you for a very, very thrilling, interesting afternoon. It's a great pleasure to be here to enjoy this lunch with you and the students, and to be guided around by charming ladies. It's a great pleasure. As I said before, we got the message. Don't worry, sleep at night. I never heard of a university going bankrupt in Israel. We in the United States also work from deficit to deficit. You know, we say we never raise enough to do the whole job. It's an ongoing job, and we're going back to the United States with a feeling that every one of us has a share in seeing that this job is carried out fully and perfectly to its ultimate. And we thank you very much. Boys, we'll have a few more here, another 5 minutes, I guess. I'm sorry about the situation. At least if we had benches, it wouldn't be so bad. We were promised a special room. Dodo Cohn made arrangements with the management, but the desk clerk on duty now can find no trace of any arrangement for a special room. And he did promise me a room for 8:30 tonight. I came out and tried to get it for 8 o'clock a few minutes ago, and he said, you can't have it until 9 o'clock now. So I gave up, and we came down here. Mr. Kaiser was supposed to be with us tonight, is not well. And we asked Mr. Fine, who was to have spoken to us the first night we arrived,
who is well,
if you recall, who is well, whether he would do it. And he's a nice guy and didn't feel that he is taking second choice. As a matter of fact, he was our first choice, and we were trying to find a suitable opportunity for him to come here and speak with us for a few minutes. Mr. Fine is an American. He's been here since 1961, I believe. Is that right? He practiced at the New York Bar for some years, then came here. He's a member of the Israeli Bar, had a great deal of experience with various problems, including some of the problems facing the youth of this country. And last year, he made a tour of the United States. It was this year, wasn't it? This spring?
Yes.
Under our Hillel University program, he visited about a dozen campuses in the United States, speaking mostly, but not exclusively, about the problems or the life of an American in Israel, the problems of adjustment, the opportunities for Americans. So he's very knowledgeable, and he's unusual in the sense that he is are you an ex-American?
Well,
you're an American who's lived in Israel for a number of years. I believe they recognize dual nationality in this country, although not in our own, so that he's in a particularly good position to tell us about what living in a country like this means for an American and what the problems of adjustment are, if there are any problems. Well, I'll ask him to say a few words, and then we can throw the questions at him.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Jameson. If you could, fellas, I'd appreciate if you could try to get in a little, because I'm sure I'm going to be hoarse very soon. I'm really very glad to meet with you. I'm very much an American, a former American, as you can tell from my, it's not a button down, but here, you know, in America, I guess I had a hang up about being Jewish. And when I came here, I found to my great surprise, as many of you will discover, we are known as Anglo-Saxons, or in Hebrew, Anglo-Sexy. So here I am an Anglo-Sexy, as you are, because we are in a country which is, some people claim, very racial, in the sense that we're all conscious this one is a Yeki and that one is a Romaneska and the third fella is a Frank, and we're all Jews and very much aware of it, which may or may not be a good thing. I've been here, as you know, for 7 years, and don't ask me why I came, although what I'd like to do tonight is talk very, very briefly and try to be as honest as I can in spite of Mr. Abramson and the tape recorder. And because I have the chance just to sense that perhaps some of you might feel that maybe they're trying to show you certain things and hide other things, and there's an image sort of, and you're the leadership and have to see what...
confronted with this kind of problem throughout the world, wherever you may be, and it's definitely worthwhile to notice and to hear my explanation and even to remember to a certain extent. We are going to see here three categories of people. The well-aged, who are still able to take care of themselves and who are active and busy. And then you are going to see the infirm aged, those who need semi-help. And then what you are seeing right now are the nursing cases, people who need 24 hours around-the-clock help. But as what I said before, and which is perfectly true also for this element of aged, which is, by the way, the most expensive from all of them, because they have to, you know, they have to be taken care of 24 hours around the clock. They have to have outside help, because many of the things that the others are able to do, they are unable to do for themselves. But one of the important things is that here we do say, first of all, up and about, even on a wheelchair, enjoy the fresh air. Because when they would be lying around in bed, there would have been a very, very difficult condition in developing all kinds of problems, medical problems, which, you know, to undo them or to heal them would have taken much, much better. In this regard, I would like to mention that, thank God, we are blessed with 9 months of sunshine, or 9 months more or less of this kind of weather, and our people are able to spend 9 months out of 12 outdoors rather than in bed. And this prevents all kinds of problems, medical problems. And as you see, they are doing whatever they can do in using their muscles, because what we say, disregard their disability and concentrate on whatever's left. Because somebody can be blind, so what? There's the tips of the use of the finger, use it. Somebody may be half paralyzed, but which means there's something that they can use still, we are using it. Incontinency and senility, anything and everything that is occurring at this age and at this time, we have it, you name it, and we have it. But what we say is, we are still taking advantage of the positive side. And if you would have seen, you see, if people don't have really families, the way that, you know, it's existing all over the world, except with us here, when people would come, you know, and visit them and be with them and show them that, you know, some kind of a recognition, who knows our people? Who recognizes them? And this is, boys, a great drawback and a difficult thing when you consider these are human beings in every and fullest sense of it. But again, what I would like you to observe here is really the occupation. They are now tired. We have arrived a little bit late. They are tired because, you see, they can only do, some of them, 1 hour of work, half an hour work, or 2 hours of work. So this is here a very important part of their life. You, as young people, take an interest that you, the fact that you have come out to see their work, to see them, this is a great thing. And that is really, when you look at them and you see the different work, what they are doing, many of them have learned it at this age right here, because again and again and again and again, there is so much that can be and should be taken out from amongst the aged. Because for the few hours that the people are occupied, it doesn't permit them to think and think, should they continue? Is it worthwhile to continue? Do I have pains here? Do I have pains there? Should I run to see the physician? Etc., etc. And as you see, there's a mental concentration, because they have to think also what they are doing. They have to count, they have to unrip, they have to rip, they are doing the weaving, etc., etc. So this is really two things achieved: the prevention of deterioration of mind and muscle. Also, in connection with that, many of them, in addition to the work that you see them doing here, may be busy and active in many different other things. One could be in helping out with the infirm, because those who can't eat themselves, who is feeding them? It is not always the young nurse. It is some of those aged who have been trained to do that. One of them, in some instances, she is responsible for feeding of 8 or 10 or 12 people. Or if somebody is blind, who would be reading? If the mental capacity of the blind person is such that they can understand, it would be a crime and a pity to leave them sit and do nothing. So it's one of the other aged who would come and fix them up, who would come and read to them, who would come to spend some time with them. In other words, we have tried to establish a family life. Now, for everything our aged do, They earn a small pocket money, which varies in every instance. The one that works in the garden helps in the garden, or the one that works in the kitchen and helps with the cooking, or the people who are doing this kind of work, whatever they do, they earn a small pocket money for a number of reasons. First of all, to encourage the work. First of all, to do the movements that we want. And as I'm repeating what I said before, but it's important enough for you not to forget it. And the only reason that's why I'm repeating it, that this is the only thing that can sort of make them want to continue. This is the only thing where there's a purpose of it tomorrow. And here in this instance, for whatever this money that they earn, they are free to dispose with it what they want. Nobody has to tell them what you want to do. They can buy their own cigarettes, their own stamps, their own soft drink. They can even buy, if they are sometimes invited to outside to somebody, they don't have to be the charity case. They can buy a little gift and bring it with them, as a present, and do something, for somebody else too. And if you look closely at them, I think Jewish tragedy is right buried in these faces. And I think if you leave that institution later, if you forget everything else about Israel, and now I'm speaking again as an Israeli, I couldn't care less. But the faces of this aged and their smiles, this is one thing you should not forget, because your parents in all the communities have helped us to do this wonderful program and this wonderful job that we are still doing. And in the back, you see, speaking about the help that we are receiving, right up there, this picture, is the late Mrs. Frieda Schiff Warburg. As you were already told on the bus, she's the late mother of Eddie Warburg, UJA chairman, national chairman, and JDC president at one time. However, you see, we cannot and will not forget the real wonderful help that for many years we have received from the Warburg family. And that's why on her 80th birthday, when Mrs. Warburg was 80 years old, this home, which is the only one from the many institutions that JDC is having in Israel, is named after her. So now look around, see some of the work before we continue. By the way, I want you to see that guy too, who is totally blind, because he was so badly beaten up by the Germans in one of the camps. He's sitting right next to you.
This little group of four people are all from, three from Romania, and this lady is from Hungary.
Ungary.
What's your story?
Ketchke,
Transylvania has.
No.
Or Diomaro, Sadomaro. Budapest. Echte Ungarn. She's real Hungarian, she says. The others are Romanian. This man, whose name is Baruch Moshe Wald,
yes.
Is that right? He's 54 years of age, and in 1940 he was drafted for slave labor by Antonescu, the Romanian dictator, and sent to dig fortifications and trenches under the Germans. Because of mistreatment, lack of food, etc., he lost his sight. And then after the war, he came here. He managed to survive. The others are from Bukovina, which is was part of Romania, now part of Russia.
Ask them about some of their reactions here.
Well, wie lange seid ihr
hier? Und 51 Jahre bin ich gekommen nach Herzi.
Yeah.
51 Jahre hat mich mal Band steht nicht für Weichen geblieben.
Yeah.
Und jetzt, das Jahr jetzt auf Malben vermacht die Fabriken.
Ja.
Als bin ich auch schon da, könnt ihr mich verstecken, was mit dem Polizei zu dürfen.
Du hast gearbeitet nach einer Fabrik von Malben?
Ja.
Was für eine Fabrik ist die noch?
Makiot für waschen die Poderliches.
Makiot für waschen?
Ja.
Das
die Schmutz, man wascht die Briten.
Und die Gabe dort,
ja.
Jetzt haben sie gemacht, die Fabrik.
Und Bekoschi, mit Schwert. Hat mich die Wolk
größer. Ja, Amen, Amen. When he came here in 1951, he... He went to work in a factory which was operated by my then. They made something for washing floors. I don't quite understand what it is. Maybe a mop. I don't understand the word. Then they closed down the factory and he ended up here. Now, hat the familie?
Ich habe nur einen Schwager.
A Schwager. He has only a brother-in-law. No, we müssen jetzt gehen.
Yeah, yeah.
What does he enjoy about living here?
Du arbeitest?
Doing the official Arbeit auf meinem Gehirn.
No, he has no official work as yet. He belongs at the Duane, your child?
No. From 9th May.
Oh, he's here since May, and apparently it's they're trying to find some place for him to work. Because he's able-bodied, he's simply blind, and they haven't been able to place him yet. Maybe this is something we should discuss with him, what they do with able-bodied. See, he worked in the factory which was closed down. I shut him down. Shalom.
The
Indians and the
Indians. Das kommt, das kommen jetzt jeden Tag kostet mir 15 Pfund ein Chodesch.
Yeah.
Und dass ich habe die Beten zusammen mit dem Tentel und so sehr viele Eltern sitzen da rein. Das hat Grutzer besucht. Grutzer von Tel Aviv.
Yeah. Well, sie kostet 15 Pfund ein Chodesch.
Mich kostet. Mich kostet.
Ich wollte du.
Nein. Wir haben noch 10 Pfund.
No. Is was is sold me though?
Ich zulde Maschinen kommen von Natania Herziger und 15 von der Chodesch.
Was steht ihr da? Mit so ein paar Dollar?
Tut nicht.
He says it cost him...
Er will noch gut zum Geld vermessen.
Yeah, all right. He says it cost him £15 a day to a month to come here. He earns nothing. He's tried to get some financial arrangement. Hasn't succeeded. I don't know what the situation is regarding this man. I think we'll have to leave now. Academy in St. Petersburg. This is Mr. Greenberg.
Yeah.
He's the erste Namen. Leon Greenberg, his card says Leon Greenberg, painting and sculpture teacher, geboren in Russland.
Yeah.
When he had an academy.
It's a shadow, Tolstoy.
Tolstoy, he knew. He ate pierogi, I guess you'd call them. Or blintzes with Tolstoy.
He was aufgewachsen in Odessa.
Odessa, geboren und aufgewachsen?
Aufgewachsen, doch.
He's from Odessa. Dort kam Chaim Nachman Bialik, is from Odessa.
Ja, hier kam es doch nach Dalny Vostok.
Ja.
Und er ging 1904 in der Melchune.
Ja. It was in 1904.
Yeah.
And he was in the war of 1905. He calls it 4, but I guess 4 or 5. Remember the war with Russia. The rest of... Yes, Russo-Japanese War.
It's been he
is now 94 years of Fido 90.
Pesach will be Bar Mitzvah.
He will be Bar Mitzvah Pesach, he says.
Pesach is the 94.
Yeah, yeah.
4 mit 9 Drats.
Yes. Oh, Pesach, he will be 94. Now, since 9 and 4 are 13, he considers he's going to be Bar Mitzvah Pesach. Wie hat er studiert Kunst?
Der Wort. Das ist
This is Albert Levin.
Yeah.
Albert Levin of Cleveland.
Oh, er will mir sein Adress.
Wie? Mr. Levin's Adress, bitte? Ich will auch geben sein Adress.
Er hat dir geschickt die Bücher.
This is Mr. Levin, is our President for the United
States. Er hat Bücher dann geschickt.
Hat er geschickt? Die Bücher Degas, Velázquez, Renoir, Family of Man. Wie hat er studiert?
In Russland.
Yeah. He studied art in Russland, in St. Petersburg. In St. Petersburg, Karatus, this is a remarkable old man. Look at this pop art he's got here. Hey.
This is
Here is the certificate. Unfortunately, I can't read Russian. It's signed by the Tsar. Was sagt das du?
I do all the medals over.
Oh, he has the medals, and this is our Namen?
Leo Greenberg.
Leo Greenberg. And what's for you? Is this?
This is
1913, and this is from the scene, St. Petersburg. In Petersburg. You have a This is Mr. Albert Levin. Yes, this is Mr. Albert Levin from Cleveland.
I have been looking for all the mechanics and lignets. Ich suche mal so, man kann es auch liegen.
He says,
er setzt die Mühle. So, sie suchen sich ein Fotografieren. Man schickt die für die Fotografie.
So he told Mr. Levin that all Americans are liars. But Mr. Levin wasn't. He did send him the books he promised. Ich will auch fragen, was hat ihr gemacht? Was ist in Amerika Pop Art? Gifts?
Gips, ja.
Oh, from plaster? Was heißt, das nicht Pop Art in Amerika? Really? Das ist hier, Hormentaschen, ein Achalle, ein Abwurst.
Jesus Christ.
Oh, sorry. Please erase that from the table.
Das ist ein Amerikaner, aber ich habe die Position, die du hast gemacht, die Muttermehl.
Muttermehl?
Er ist ein großer Schild.
Ja, ja.
Du hast gesagt, es ist Muttermehl gemacht worden, die Kröllchen. Sechs Kröllchen sind
gekrönt. Some fellow came here and he brought it from the synagogue. He said, I'll tell them they're made from matzah flour, matzahmehl, instead of plaster.
How long has he been here?
Wie lange seid ihr du, Mr. Greenberg?
Du bin schon 12
Jahre. Und 94 Jahre, sein Bar Mitzvah Pesach, 9 und 4 ist 13.
But
she lived in China for a long time. No, Ashenim Dank and Hasak, you are
going to
give you the address for Mr. Levin. Thank you.
Judaism preaches tolerance from the point of view of saying all men are equal. Widows and orphans have to be taken care of. No man should gather so much property that he puts house next to house so that there's no land left in between. In other words, don't be a hog. Leave something for somebody else. It's tolerant in regard to women. It's tolerant in regard to many things. It's even tolerant in regard to letting another man believe what he wants to believe. It's a tolerant religion in the sense that it doesn't insist that this is the code of the credo, and if you don't believe it, we'll hang you. There never has been an inquisition by Jews against Jews, like there is by Catholics against Catholics who don't believe the right thing. As a matter of fact, Jews never could quite agree on what they did believe. Maimonides said the Jewish religion can be reduced to 13 principles that you're supposed to believe. Somebody came after him, Nachmanides, who said, nah, it isn't 13, it's only 3. If you believe these 3 things, that's enough. Jews were very tolerant on what they considered to be the basic essence of their own religious belief. But that's Judaism being tolerant as a religion. Judaism being tolerant as a religion to its own followers doesn't mean all religions are tolerant to each other. Now, the Orthodox have one intolerant attitude, and that's toward the state having been created by men rather than by the Messiah. According to the Orthodox, strictly Orthodox belief, this state of Israel should be reconstituted only in the final days of the Messiah, not before. And who the hell does Chaim Weizmann think he is? And who the hell does Ben-Gurion think he is? To try to reconstitute this state before the Messiah came? That is the one thing they're intolerant about. And I'll never forget, as long as I live, one night that I was talking to some Hasidim of a famous rabbi from Poland from Ger, G-E-R. These Hasidic groups are known by the names of the towns from which the rabbi came. Ger is the town he came from. He's called the Gerer, G-E-R-E-R, the Gerer Rebbe. The Gerer Rebbe has got a lot of Hasidim in Jerusalem, many thousands. I went one night on the night of Slichot. That's a prayer that you say at midnight, a month before Rosh Hashanah, to begin to put yourself in the mood to purify yourself and cleanse yourself. And you begin at midnight, and every night for 30 days at midnight you say prayers of penitence, asking God to forgive you for all the dirty, filthy, evil thoughts in your head and all the dirty, evil deeds you've done. And you've got to cleanse yourself, so you come to Rosh Hashanah clean. And it's called Slichot, which means penitence. On the first night of Slichot, which is about, you know, sometime in August, the end of August, month before Rosh Hashanah, I went there to the place of the Gera Rebbe at midnight, and he didn't come. He deliberately waits till 1, 2, 3 o'clock, because he wants to get everybody in a big mood of expecting him, and he gets them all hot, and the atmosphere gets tense. So around midnight when I came, it was still a little bit early, and I run into a bunch of these Hasidim standing in the courtyard, and they're dressed in their long black coats and in their big heavy Russian boots, or Polish boots. This costume is derived from Poland in the 18th century. It's 200 years old. They don't change it. And we start having a conversation, and I decide really to try to find out what they think, and I ask them about the state of Israel as a state. And one of them goes, "That's in the city of Jerusalem, in the holy city of Jerusalem." So I say, "Whoa." So he says, just like you do in front of a church, you spit three times when you pass a church. So I said, "All right, buddy, you know, let's..." Yeah, whoa, is right. So then he starts saying about this is evil, that the city is full of desecrators of the Sabbath, haters of God, fornicators, evil men, and the cars run on the Shabbat, and they are going to continue to throw the stones, and everything that's gone wrong here is because men created this place, not God. So I asked him the $64 question, what would he really prefer to do? And he said he really would prefer to live Me'ever Hayarden, on the other side of the Jordan, namely among the Arabs. And at that point, I was ready to haul off and let him have it.
Why did he come to Israel?
Well, he's coming here waiting for the Messiah to come. And you and your lousy short pants are going around making a stinkhole out of this place. You're making it irreligious, you're making it rotten, you're making it secular, you're goyish. He came here waiting for God to come, for the Messiah to come, to reconstitute Israel.
It's got a long wait.
Sure it is. He doesn't care.
Is that why they handed over the gates to the Arabs?
And you loused it up. And everybody liked you. And he started to let me have it. And I started to let him have it. And we were in one hell of a fight. And there was a big gang began to gather, and it really looked threatening, and I'm not kidding, because they were starting to mumble Epicurus, which means, I don't know how you translate it, which means somebody who turns, who converts, not a faithful Jew, traitor. And the what saved the whole situation, he showed up, exactly. You could hear him from about two, three blocks away coming, pounding his boots on the cobblestones. And then, just like you hear wind whistling through the wheat, rustles, you could hear the whispering of the people from two, three blocks away, saying in Yiddish, they won't speak Hebrew, "Der Rebbe kommt." The rabbi, what?
Here comes the judge.
The rabbi is coming. The rabbi is coming. Der Rebbe kommt. Der Rebbe kommt. Der Rebbe kommt. Der Rebbe kommt. And the boots are pounding on the cobblestone. And when he comes swinging around the corner, and he's got 10 guys around him, that's called his court. and they hit into the central yard here where there are by now a couple thousand people waiting, and they see him, and he's quite a figure of a man. He has a long, big red beard. And then, like, you know, there Rebbe's God! He's here. He's here. And just like you get a Shekhinah, a holy mood in the place, the Spirit of God has arrived. Now, you know, you look at that and you say to yourself, that is 18th century Polish Hasidic enthusiasm, conviction, powerful, more powerful than anything I believe. I'm the first one to admit it. Their religious convictions will carry them through anything. Slaughter, death. They just won't lift a hand to fight for the state. But if the Goyim want to go and cut their throats, that they're willing to do. It's this clear, perverted obstinacy which has kept them alive, and yet which in today's Israel makes them an anachronism. Now somebody's out of step. And your question was, why are they out of step? And the one thing that makes them out of step is they are intolerant of anyone who interferes with the process of the Messiah coming. That's the bit. Well, we go on building the country anyway, whether they like it or not. And sooner or later, either they'll say the Messiah has done it, or they'll still be out of step 500 years from now. Now, I forget the second half of your question. Cultural versus religious state. That brings up your question over here of Jews being a religion or a culture or a nationality. Take yourselves. What are you? You are Americans by nationality. You are Jews by what? Culture? Culture means language. Do you know either one of the two Jewish languages, Hebrew or Yiddish? Culture means literature. Do you know Jewish literature? Beginning with the Bible, how well do you know the Bible? How well do you know Jewish philosophy, poetry, short stories, novels, mysticism, essays? All these things are written in both Hebrew and in Yiddish. And by the way, moreover, all now translated into English even.
They're all experts on Leon Uris.
All experts on Leon Uris. This is a form of Jewish literature. And by the way, I don't demean it any more than I demean Michener. A lot of people know, or all they know about Israel is what they learned from Exodus, or all they know about archaeology is what they learned from the source. But that's better than knowing nothing. So I'm back on the point. You are a Jew by virtue of what? Culture? Well, do you know the language and literature of this culture? You know Middle English, Chaucerian English, Beowulf. You know Shakespearean English, different from today. You know the language and the literature of the English culture. Do you know the language and literature of the Jewish culture? Are you therefore Jews culturally? You have to answer that for yourself. Somebody may say yes, somebody may say no. Be honest, that's all I ask. So you call yourselves Jews. Are you Jews culturally? Second thing, are you Jews religiously? Now, in the United States, you've got an option. You can be religiously Orthodox or conservative or Reform or Reconstructionist, and all those are legitimate options as a form of religious expression. So if you are authentically religious in any one of those forms, then you can say, well, I'm not really a Jew culturally because I don't know much about the Jewish culture, but I am a Jew religiously. I have a form of religious belief and I practice it. But supposing you don't do that. Supposing you're not a Jew either culturally, or you're not a Jew religiously, then what are you? Then you're a Jew by virtue of what?
Birth.
Membership in the club. You're a member of the club. You didn't even ask to be made a member. Somebody else made you a member. You didn't ask to be circumcised. You didn't exercise much choice about it at that tender age. So somebody paid your membership dues, registered you in the club for life, made damn sure that it was recognizable for life by cutting it into your flesh, and say, okay, you're now a member of this club from the day you're born till the day you die, and you can't get out. You can't resign even. Because if you resign and you go and you convert, they'll call you for the rest of your life that Christian Jew. Now, if you're not a Jew culturally and you're not a Jew religiously, then you are a Jew by being a member of the club. But a member of the club is a very bad phrase. It's not very elegant. So what kind of an elegant phrase do we use? We say you are a member of the Jewish people. The Jewish people. You are a Jew by virtue of being born into the Jewish people. All right? Now you begin to get a very close shading between what's the difference between the Jewish people and the Jewish nationality. That already begins to be harder to define. Culture, easy to define. Religion, easy to define. People, how is that distinct from nationality or nationhood? See? So the Israeli says, I am an Israeli by nationality, I am a Jew by peoplehood, and maybe by culture, because I know a lot about the Jewish culture, and maybe even by religion, because I might even practice that. So I am a total and complete and whole Jew. I got it both ways. I'm an Israeli by nationality, I'm a Jew by culture, religion, folklore, tradition, peoplehood. So that's why he says to you, you're an American by nationality, but you're a Jew by culture, religion, tradition, peoplehood. What the hell, why don't you go the whole hog? And why don't you become a complete Jew, both sides? And why don't you come over here? And then you're not a schizophrenic, you're not a split personality. You're not a Canadian by nationality. You know, Canadian nationality, that's also got Eskimos, it's got Indians, it's got all kinds of funny tribes. You're not a Canadian by nationality and a Jew by culture or religion. Why split yourself? Come here, make yourself a whole person again, integrated, then you are an Israeli Jew, or a Jewish Israeli. And that brings up the last question, which you didn't ask, Willie, but I don't think you did, Al, but it's part of it, and that is, what are you first? Are you an American first, or are you a Jew first? Now, the Israeli says, I got no problem. Doesn't matter a damn to me whether you call me an Israeli first or a Jew first, or a Jew second and Israeli first. It's the same thing. However, just to complicate it one step further, this atheistic, irreligious Mr. Ben-Gurion says, it does matter. And I am not religious. But if you ask me, am I a Jew first or am I an Israeli first? I give you my answer clear as a bell. I am Israeli nationalist number one. I created this state. I built this army. I am the super nationalist. But if you ask me, what am I first? I am a Jew first and I'm Israeli second. And that's the position he takes. And therefore, he says logically, he expects me to say, I'm a Jew first and an American second. He expects Baron Rothschild to say he's a Jew first and a Frenchman second. He expects everybody in the world to put the Jew first and the nationality, whatever it happens to be, second. And only if the nationality is Israeli, then there's less conflict between being a Jew and an Israeli. That's his logic. I'd like to hear what you think about it.
Why
does he say that? Because he says being a Jew is a quality, a special quality, and this irreligious man believes that the Jews are a very special people. He won't say God chose them to be the chosen people. All he says is, there's a Hebrew phrase, Am Segula. That means like a precious jewel, a special people, a precious people, a unique people, a different people, a people like no other people in the whole world. Now, by the way, it so happens that I believe that too about the Jewish people. I believe that the Jewish people is absolutely unique, separate, different, special, with characteristics of its own, with possibilities of its own, with potentialities of its own, quite different from any other people on the face of the earth. And he won't put it in religious terms. He won't say the Jews are special because God chose them. That's what the religious Jew says. Ata bachartanu. You chose us, O God, from all the peoples on earth. You chose us to make us your special people. So the religious Jew believes that this process of election, selection, came from God. And Gurion doesn't believe that. What he says is, I believe it comes from history. I look at all the peoples in history. The Chinese and the Hindus and the Babylonians and the Egyptians and the Greeks and the Romans, I look at them all. There is no people on the face of this earth in all the thousands of years of recorded human history, since men learn how to write, since he ceased being an animal and became a man who could think and create speech and write, there's been no people like the Jewish people. And history made them what they are. So he says, being a Jew is more important even than being an Israeli, but when the Jew comes back to the land in which he was born and becomes the citizen of that land and adopts the nationality of that land and speaks the language of that land, all going back to 4,000 years ago when it began, then he is really being a full Jew. So I believe that being a Jew is the most important thing in the world. And second, being an Israeli rather than being an American or a Greek or a Turk or a Swede or a Bulgar or a Chinaman. That's why he believes the Jew first.
Doesn't that add credence to the view, like the Polish view, that you're a disloyal faction of the country because you were a Jew?
Yes, sir. It does. Every country in the world that has had Jews living in it in any large numbers and has never been able to digest those Jews, has never been able to turn them into Poles, they always remain Jews. Never been able to turn them into Russians, they always remain Jews. Never been able to turn them into Americans, they always remain Jews. Aren't we distinctly Jews? You know damn well we are. We are also Americans. We understand baseball and chewing gum and like everybody else.
What does that have to do with, how does that affect the, like, basic loyalties? Like the whole basis of the national state is based on its primary loyalty.
All right, that's a correct point. As far as that's concerned, Jews have always been very, very careful to observe the practice of loyalty to the host country which was giving them their citizenship or their nationality. We didn't go to Frankfurt. there wasn't one to show you in Munich, so I couldn't have shown it to you. But if I had taken you to Frankfurt, I would have shown you in the Jewish cemetery a great big sign. What?
We saw it in East Berlin. You know, once it died in World War
I. Oh, you saw it in East Berlin. Fine. Now here you saw, and the Nazis never destroyed such tablets. Never. Here you saw a sign which says, Jews were loyal to the fatherland. Loyal to the fatherland, Germany in World War I. Jews were fighting on the side of Germany in World War I. Jews were fighting on the side of France, England, and America, World War I. Jews in the trenches undoubtedly shot and killed each other on both opposite sides. They were paying their loyalty to the country of their citizenship. They always did. Sometimes I think stupidly, but they always did. Jews paid their loyalty to every single country, to Rome. Jews who were citizens of Rome paid their loyalty to Rome. The whole problem of Josephus, we're not sure. He was a Jewish general who, when he became a Roman general, paid his loyalty to Rome. Maybe even he was a traitor to the Jews, we're not sure. That problem has never occurred. Even when we pay our loyalty to the country of our nationality in the greatest way we can, not just by paying taxes, but by giving our lives, even then, they are not sure that the host majority group is not sure that they understand us or can feel friendly to us. They're not sure. See, I am a funny guy. I don't look for anti-Semites under every bed. I don't believe in that. I really don't. I think that America today is absolutely magnificently clear of anti-Semitism as any country has been in the history of the human race. It's a fact. I think there are still pockets of anti-Semitism, so what the hell? Jews can't get up high in the banking world or in the insurance company. So what? There's a difference. They do fine, so we crack that. The United States is as clean and clear and decent a country as Jews have ever lived in their entire history. What? And I don't worry about anti-Semitism in America, and I don't think that every non-Jew in America looks at me behind my back and calls me dirty Jew. I really don't. I really don't. On the other hand, I know this perfectly well. 200 million Americans have got 5.5 million Jews living in their midst, and they will be goddamned if they can understand us with the best will in the world. They can't. The best will in the world. They want to. You'll never know how many non-Jews I've had come to me and say, will you explain this Jewish people to me? I really don't dig them. How many are there in America? 20 million? 40 million? I say 5.5. They say it's impossible. Everywhere you turn, there's a Jew. The Jews are so visible. There's so many of them. They want everything. I say, no, they don't. What do you Jews believe? They're curious about us. They consider us something quite different. Now, don't misunderstand me, gentlemen. We are very much part of the fabric of America. America is a three-religion country, and everybody makes believe that all three religions are equal. Catholics, Protestants, and Jews. We all speak in those terms. But there are 5 million Jews, and there are 40 million Catholics, and there are 160 million Protestants. So we really ain't all equal. And yet it appears to be that we are. And we are accepted as equals.